Pants. This is Gary, and this is I'll Have a Beer and Talk, the only show hosted by me, recorded in an undisclosed location somewhere underneath Portland, Oregon, where I drink a randomly selected craft beer and talk about stories that interested me from the past week or two's tech news cycle until I finish that beer. This has been a crazy couple of days for me, both professionally and privately. We'll get to that privately thing. Multiple tech developer conferences went on last week, and my day job has been quite busy, so I barely had enough mental bandwidth to skim over tech news over the past 2 weeks. But don't worry, I've got some good stories to talk about. But in order to do that, I need to wet my whistle. To help me make as random a beer choice as possible without going all quantum, I use what is essentially a spinning wheel called the randomizer. And there it is. Listen to it spin. Round and round it goes. What beer it lands on, nobody knows. Until now. This week's beer is Propolis Brewing's Beltane Herbal Golden, a 7% ABV Saison! Hooray! Fake summer has returned to Portland, and it's in the 80s for the next couple days. It was 90 today. So a Saison is exactly what I need. Saisons are ales traditionally brewed by farmers in the winter in Belgium to be enjoyed throughout the summer. So it's not so much a specific flavor as it is a style of brewing. But every Saison I've had tastes kind of like liquid sunshine. I expect this one will also taste the same, but also like elderflowers, because this one is brewed with elderflowers. I am ready to annihilate this brew, so let's switch to the beer mic so I can drink. Okay, this has never happened before. There's a cork under the cap. I have to go find a corkscrew. Hang on a second. Ah! Got one. And this has also never happened to me with this show before. It was a very light pour because it foamed up like instantly as it comes out of the bottle. So I'll have to edit out a part where I wait for it to settle a little bit before I can give you the taste. But I can tell you it definitely smells very, very floral, which makes sense because of elderflowers. It smells also very tart and kind of sugary. So hopefully it'll taste like liquid sunshine and elderflowers and all those things I just mentioned. Very, very interesting flavors going on here. It's very floral, like I said. Tastes a little bit like grassy notes, very tart, a little bitter on the very high end. Kind of feels like smelling a field of grass and dandelions. It's kind of the closest thing I can think of to imagining the flavor, but it is lovely, quite lovely. Very dry, too. So this is going to be an excellent, excellent beverage for a 90-degree day. So as I said, the majority of my brain has been so absorbed by my day job that I almost missed Microsoft's Build Developer Conference and the Google I/O Developer Conference, both of which happened last week at the same time. Talking about developer conferences from these two tech titans is tricky business. They are developer conferences, after all, and stuff that developers salivate over tend to put the regular end user consumer to sleep. Tools are presented to developers, then developers use those tools to make the interesting applications. So it's a little tough to see what could be the next thing consumers really gravitate towards. Nothing particularly revelatory came from Microsoft, other than the resurrection of their Kinect technology as part of their Azure server services, which I really did not really make that much sense to me, because I'm not a developer. But they also had an interesting application called Your Phone being developed to enable some pretty deep interactivity between Android and iOS phones and Windows 10 on the desktop. Something along the lines of you being able to pull photos and copy-paste text wirelessly from your phone onto your PC and vice versa, which, to me at least, would be extremely useful. That's supposed to be rolled out later in the fall. Google, meanwhile, doubled down on integrating their assistant AI into pretty much every product they have, such as Gmail, Maps, Photos, News, etc. But the story that got the most attention was Google Duplex. If you're like me, an introvert that would prefer to not have direct interactions with humans I don't already know, you know the pain of wanting to book a haircut, know a business's hours, or make reservations or place a takeaway or delivery order with a restaurant, only to discover that business doesn't have any way of doing that over the internet. You have to make an actual phone call. Duplex is designed to take that burden off your plate. Utilizing all that deep learning they've been developing and refining for their AI systems, Google has managed to make a smart artificial assistant that can call businesses over the telephone and can book a salon appointment, inquire as to a business's holiday hours, or interact with a restaurant to place an order or make reservations autonomously. Don't believe me? Here's a call I'm sure we've all had to make where native language could cause some confusion and stress.
See, how may I help you?
Hi, I'd like to reserve a table for Wednesday the 7th.
For 7 people?
It's for 4 people.
4 people? When?
Next night? Wednesday at 6 p.m.
Oh, actually, we reserve for like upper, like 5 people. For 4 people, you can come.
How long is the wait usually to be seated?
When, tomorrow or weekday or?
For next Wednesday, the 7th.
Oh, no, it's not too busy. You can come for 4 people, okay?
Oh, I gotcha. Thanks.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Amaze. I think this is great. I would have zero qualms about trying out multiple different local businesses if I can use a virtual assistant to take care of the largest point of friction for me. And I assume other introverts as well. First contact. Duplex did cause quite a bit of debate in the tech journalism sphere. There was a bizarre op-ed on The Verge where they said this technology would overwhelm local businesses to the point where they would fail because everyone would be calling them with their assistance for their services, which really doesn't make that much sense to me. Others immediately went to the businesses will have virtual assistants taking calls, and it's bots talking to bots, and the next thing you know, it's bots all the way down, which I guess, I'm shrugging, you can't see me. There's also a strange pushback with some people demanding that if these assistant bots start calling, they need to inform the person on the other end that they are a bot, which, with these specific scenarios, haircuts, hours, restaurants, doesn't make any sense to me. What's the demonstrable harm to a human if a robot calls to ask when the place they work at is open and doesn't tell the human that they are a robot? Huh? Another argument was that it would make it easy for an indecisive person to continually change appointments, but the bot will be polite about every single call, so what's the harm other than frustration about moving an appointment on a calendar? That's better than having a human screaming at the poor receptionist about how who knows what when they can't seem to find time to get their hair done. Now, I understand the long-term issues this technology could produce, and yes, we should be talking about how this can be exploited and try to prevent it from being exploited, like bots being used for telephone scams. We actually are talking about that right now, but immediately lighting up the torches and breaking out the pitchfork seems a wee bit premature for me. Google Duplex is not an actual product. What was presented at I/O was a tech demo, and Google said that they do a limited rollout of just those three uses, booking a salon, calling about hours, and making reservations or placing orders with a restaurant. It's not the beginning of a robot rebellion. It's giving people who, either by mental or physical issues, can't make phone calls. And I welcome our new talking robot overlords. Being an introvert, and being married to an introvert, we're particularly picky about who we consider our friends. We like to spend our private time with smart, funny, compassionate, pragmatic people, much like ourselves. It's eerie when we find other people that we click with pretty quickly. It's like we share the same brain. Business Insider says, according to research, that the shared brain feeling might actually be real. In a recent study published in Nature Communications, researchers from Dartmouth College and the University of California recruited some students to take a friend survey. Fun. 279 youths were asked who they were friends with in their classes, and a group of 42 friendship-bonded students were asked to watch video clips while sitting in an MRI machine. The data from the MRI scanning showed that the students who declared they were friends with each other had the same neurological responses to the videos. Areas of the brain associated with learning, motivation, memory, and affective processing lit up similarly between friends. So similarly, in fact, that the researchers could predict which students were friends just by the brain scans. Neural responses to dynamic, naturalistic stimuli like videos can give us a window into people's unconstrained, spontaneous thought processes as they unfold, said Carolyn Parkinson, the lead author of the study. Our results suggest that friends process the world around them in exceptionally similar ways. A related study into friendships also seems to indicate that people who are genuine friends are similar at a genetic level as well as neurologically. Researchers from the universities Duke, Stanford, and the University of Wisconsin did some genetic comparison tests using a dataset of 5,500 American adolescents, publishing their results in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Basically, they found out that friends are more genetically similar than people who aren't friends, which aligns with a phenomenon known as social homophily. People with similar backgrounds, education, and even similar height and weight tend to gravitate towards one another. So, in a way, if Gizmodo, a blog that I read all the time, was a person, I'd totally be friends with it, because I found so many of the stories personally interesting this week that the rest of the stories in this episode all came from Gizmodo. We're besties. I love the moon, and would like to have a chance to live on it someday. Something about the sterile, stark beauty really appeals to me. Plus, it's close enough to the planet where all my current favorite stuff comes from, the planet Earth. In order for humans to live on the moon, they first need two essential things: oxygen to breathe and water to drink. Luckily, water can be turned into oxygen, so they really only need one important thing: water. I've talked a lot about how water could be pretty much everywhere on the moon, be it mixed in with the very surface or lurking in big frozen chunks in deep, dark craters, but hard evidence has been pretty hard to come by so far. Until now! According to Gizmodo, a lunar meteorite was discovered in Africa 13 years ago, and it might be the proof that water does indeed exist on the moon. The meteorite has traces of moganite in it, a mineral that can only form if there's water around. A team from Sendai, Japan's Tohoku University, led by Masahiro Kaya, analyzed a bunch of lunar meteorites found in northwest Africa and published their findings in Science Advances. To date, 300 lunar meteorites have been found on Earth. The moon has been taking a beating for many space objects for pretty much its entire life, and occasionally the debris from collisions rain down upon the Earth. One sample from the study, named NWA-2727, in case you need to know that for trivia night, contained moganite. Moganite is a form of silicon dioxide, first discovered in 1976, which only forms during a chemical process that requires water, called brecciation, and comes in the form of crystal-like structures within cracks in rocks. The research team believes that water-rich asteroids and comets delivered water to the moon roughly 3 billion years ago with such rapidity that liquid water may have existed on the surface for a brief period, eventually seeping below the surface and cooling, becoming trapped within the moon itself. The researchers are quick to point out that the moganite seen in the lunar meteorites was not formed on the Earth's surface due to weathering. The areas where the meteorites have been found are simply too arid to allow for brecciation to happen. To really, really finally have definitive proof that there is water on the moon and that it's still there, the researchers put out a call for fresh lunar samples to be collected and brought back to Earth on future lunar missions. Noah Petro, a lunar geologist with NASA, told Gizmodo that this discovery is big. This is a clear detection of water ice for a surface sample from the moon. That water was near enough to the surface to interact with lunar minerals tells us something about the volatile history of the moon, and by association, the rest of the solar system. It also highlights the need to study Apollo samples with modern analytical techniques. He added, "There are Apollo samples that have never been studied, and it's high time we looked at them. It also shows that we have a limited understanding of the moon based only on Apollo and Luna samples. It's time to get more samples from the moon." And I agree completely. And if there's water on the moon, then we can grow plants. Plants contain cellulose. Combine that cellulose with water, and guess what? You've made paper! It's really that simple. Kind of. And you can learn more at this show's sponsor, Pulp and Deckel. Pulp and Deckel is Portland's only community handmade paperinking studio, and its mission is to keep the art of paperinking alive with workshops, demonstrations, creating and selling beautiful handmade paper products, and working with artists in creating all styles of art through the medium of papermaking. Browse a rotating selection of papermaking workshops, inquire about custom orders, take an online recycled papermaking class, and check out all the amazing things we do with the ancient art of papermaking by visiting pulpanddeckel.com. That is pulpanddeckle.com. And if you do get in touch with Pulp and Deckel, if you mention I'll Have a Beer and Talk, we might give you something special. My new friend Gizmodo told me that scientists find another possible explanation for why hair goes gray. Our hair, along with our skin and eyes, get their color from melanin, a substance produced by cells found throughout the skin and other body parts called melanocytes. Melanocytes are one of the first sets of cells to die off as the body ages, so going a little gray is a sign that, yes, you are mortal, meatbag. Anyway, in a study published in PLOS Biology, scientists believe they found a gene that regulates melanin and also keeps the body's immune system from attacking itself. My lab harnesses the power of mouse models of hair graying to better understand stem cells and aging. The stem cells we study are the melanocyte stem cells in the hair follicle, which are the stem cells that are essential for producing melanocytes. Lead study author Melissa Harris, an assistant professor of biology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, told Gizmodo via email. The research team were intrigued by a gene called melanogenesis associate transcription factor, also known as MITF, which is found in melanocytes. When looking at the genetics of mice specifically bred to gray early, they noticed that the MITF production in those mice was unusually high, possibly burning out the melanocytes prematurely. So they bred mice that produced less MITF, expecting to see a reduction in the graying, but you won't believe what happened next. The mice with the reduced MITF went gray just about as quickly as those cranking out MITFs. So what the hell is going on? It appears that MITF, in addition to controlling the melanocyte's melanin production, also controls genes that are responsible for releasing interferons. Interferons are part of the immune system. They are proteins that fight foreign invaders within the body by interfering with viral replication and also activate the production of white blood cells and more antigens to coordinate immune cells' attacks on appropriate targets. The mice with the melanocytes that produced less MITF made way more interferon instead, tricking the immune system into attacking the melanocytes, leading to the same result, graying hair. I personally like my gray hairs. I think it gives my normal slovenly appearance a little more of a distinguished look. But knowing a little bit more about the process of why it happens could possibly lead to ways of delaying it for those that do not want. Did you know that plants don't like to get too close to each other and have the ability to communicate that? It's true. And my best friend Gizmodo told me about it. Much like myself, plants generally don't like to be touched, which is a little tricky because plants can't move around a whole lot to avoid it. Unless they're triffids. Anyway, being touched tells a plant that it's growing too close to other plants, and new research published in PLOS One demonstrates that touch-sensitive plants let their neighbors know about it through chemical signals, which causes the nearby plants to adjust their growth patterns. Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences Velimir Ninkovic conducted some experiments with corn seedlings in a growth solution to discover this little-studied plant behavior. He lightly brushed the seedling's leaves to simulate the touch of a nearby plant leaf. Aw, massaging leaves. Causing the seedling to secrete chemicals out from its roots and into the growth solution. When Ninkovic used the chemical-infused growth solution to grow new seedlings, the seedlings grew more leaves, but fewer roots, when compared to the controls. To see if the response was repeatable and not simply random, cord seedlings were planted in a way where they had access to two different growth solutions, one infused with the keep-away juice, the other unsullied. The researchers observed the seedling's primary root move towards the regular growth solution, indicating that the seedlings could tell the difference between the two solutions, or at least understand the chemical signal present, as it came from the same genetic line of corn seedlings. Our results show that the above-ground plant-plant communication by brief touch can provoke responses in nearby non-touched plants through below-ground communication, wrote the authors in the study. This indicates that responses to neighboring plants can be significantly affected by the physical conditions to which these neighbors are exposed to. It also suggests that plant-plant below-ground communication is modified by above-ground mechanical stimulation. This reaction shows plants are similar to humans, acting both altruistically and selfishly. The plant being touched warns its family to stay away from the area if it wants all the delicious sunlight it can handle, and it also makes sure its immediate area doesn't get any more crowded, depriving it of sunlight. So like us. My boyfriend Gizmodo says that we should lick chickens to be healthier, physically and mentally. Okay, it doesn't exactly say that. What it does say is that a new study published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Science does seem to indicate that growing up in environments where we encounter more human and animal germs tends to produce a stronger immune system later in life, which also enables one to handle stress more effectively. It's called the hygiene hypothesis, where the immune system needs to encounter lots of relatively harmless foreign germs and substances in order to learn how to function when a real emergency happens. If an immune system is kept in a clinical environment during a person's development, it can overreact to things it shouldn't, like ragweed or peanuts. Lots of research has already shown that people that grow up in rural areas or with pets tend to have lower rates of autoimmune disorders, and those that grew up in urban areas have higher rates of allergies and autoimmune disorders. In this new study, with researchers at Germany's University of Ulm, they recruited 40 strapping young and healthy German men to take part in an experiment. Half of the men said they were raised on farms around lots of animals, and the other half were raised in the city with no pets. Both groups had saliva and blood samples taken before, during, and after the experiment at various points. The volunteers were given tasks designed to produce stress. First, they were told to give a speech to a group of people, specifically mentioned as wearing lab coats. And again, I'm shrugging, you can't see me. A speech about why they deserve their dream job of choice, and then they had to count backwards from 3,079 in increments of 17. Damn. According to the blood tests, the men raised in cities had higher levels of certain blood cells and proteins, specifically peripheral blood mononuclear cells, also known as PBMCs, and interleukin-6. Higher levels than the farm folk. The presence of both those indicate the city dudes had a stronger inflammatory reaction to the stress situations. And those higher levels persisted in their blood for up to 2 hours after the experiment, unlike the farm dudes. In our field of research, this social stress test is the most effective way to induce a neuroendocrine stress response. And we know it induces a pro-inflammatory response in humans that is exaggerated in people who have major depressive disorder, for example. Study researcher Christopher Lowry, a professor of integrative physiology at Colorado University Boulder, told Gizmodo, "Inflammation is a crucial part of a healthy immune system. However, previous research has suggested that people who have chronic, low levels of inflammation are at higher risk of developing mental health disorders like major depression." So city folk have bad reactions to stress and crappy immune systems and are sad. Got it. They should just move to the country. But hang on a minute. The farm boys had some stress reactions too. They reported they felt far more stressed while participating in the experiment than the city men reported. And their saliva showed higher levels of cortisol, a hormone whose presence is indicative of stress, much higher levels than the city men's saliva did. Cortisol is a key component of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, a pathway that runs along our brain and hormonal glands that regulates everything from digestion to our flight and fight reaction. The presence of PBMCs and interleukins brought on by an overactive immune response to stress might not affect cortisol levels, and vice versa. Lowry finds the disparity in stress reactions, considering the reactions linked to mental and physical health, alarming, saying that, quote, "There's a massive increase worldwide in urbanization, and by 2050, two-thirds of the world's population is expected to live in cities. So we're gradually shifting towards an existence that creates a mismatch between our evolutionary past and co-evolved relationship with things like microorganisms. One thing we can anticipate is that we will somehow have to compensate for the lack of exposure, especially during development, to these microorganisms." Lowry added, "And the strategy for doing that is not quite clear. Hopefully we can resolve that over time." So, lick chickens and eat peanuts as a child, and be surrounded by cats at all times, and you should be A-okay! Disclaimer, I am not a licensed physician. My life partner Gizmodo whispered in my ear that hibernating squirrels could hold the key to better preservation of human organs for transplantation. Yes, frozen squirrels are the key to immortality! Or not. First, here's some facts. According to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, roughly 35% of all U.S. deaths could be prevented, or at least delayed, by organ transplantation. 95% of Americans support organ donation, but only 40% of Americans are registered donors. For the record, I totally am. I don't think anyone would want my liver the shape that it's in right now, but I think I still have some good stuff in this old meat shell. Anyway, with this in mind, you should also be aware that the availability of organs doesn't exactly line up with a patient's need. So we need to learn how to freeze those organs safely and thaw them out in a non-destructive way when they are needed. And that's where the hibernating squirrels come in. In a paper published in the journal Cell from research conducted by scientists at the National Eye Institute, senior investigator Wei Li from the Retinal Neurophysiology section at the NAI and colleague Jinjing U studied the cells of the hibernating common 13-line ground squirrel. They are so named because they have 13 alternating brown and white lines along the length of their little bodies. These squirrel cells contain microtubule cytoskeletons, which sound really, really metal, but are actually, according to the article, small tubes that form strong structural networks within cells while also allowing for the transportation of organelles and molecular compounds required for cellular health and survival. Wow. Li and U compared the cells of non-hibernating animals, like humans and their close relatives, rats, and cells of the 13-line squirrels, comparing the cells' reactions to cold temperatures. When brought down to freezing, the microtubule cytoskeletons in squirrel brain cells were unaffected by the temperatures, but the same structures in the human and rat neural cells collapsed, killing those brain cells. To find out what makes the squirrel cytoskeleton so special, the researchers reprogrammed cells from newborn 13-line squirrels into stem cells, preserving the cold-resistant skeletons. They then coaxed the new stem cells to develop into neural cells and compared the genetic expression of the new neural cells with similarly stem cell-derived human neural cells when exposed to cold. The human cells overproduced a reactive oxygen compound, which is known as an ROS, that caused oxidation of proteins along its cytoskeletons, causing the microtubules to collapse. The new cells' ROS levels remained low, and their cytoskeleton tubules stood firm. Both cells' exposure to the cold impaired the ability of the neurons to dispose of proteases, which are toxic oxidized proteins, which lead to the collapse of nearby microtubules. The researchers then looked into if it was possible to suppress the ROS increase in the cells of non-hibernating species. They dosed human and rat cells with a drug that reduces ROS production and inhibits protease activity, then exposed the cells to a 4 degrees Celsius environment for 24 hours, and the microtubules remained intact. Tests with mice kidney cells and rat retinal cells also showed structural resiliency after cooling and warming with this technique. By understanding the biology of cold adaptation in hibernation, we may be able to improve and broaden the applications of induced hypothermia in the future, and perhaps prolong the viability of organs prior to transplantation, said Li in a statement. Kidneys, for example, are typically stored for no more than 30 hours. After that, the tissue starts to deteriorate, impairing the organ's ability to function properly after it's been rewarmed and restored. Heart, lungs, and livers have an even shorter shelf life. But with this technique, they can last a lot longer. A lot more research needs to be done, but if in the future you get a thawed organ slapped in you, you can thank your friendly neighborhood 13-line ground squirrel! Squirrel power. Hello everyone! Did you know that this show is not only supported by Pulp and Deckel, but it's supported by loyal listeners just like you? If you enjoy the show, want to join in on the fun? I've got three choices for you. You can always hire me for some voice and audio production work. I can do voicemail messages, mediocre acting, bad singing, and some adequate audio production. I actively edit and produce this show, and I also edit the Paper Talk podcast. Have you heard that one? It's pretty interesting if you're into paper making. If you feel you or someone you know might have a use for the best part of my body, which happens to be my voice and my brain, let me know. Email me at gary@pulpanddeckel.com. That is G-A-R-Y at P-U-L-P-A-N-D-D-E-C-K-L-E.com. Rates are reasonable. And here's an open podcast industry secret. If you rate and review this show on iTunes, the more I Have As discoverability will go up for people looking for Beery Tech Podcasts on iTunes. It shows up as a recommended suggestion, and if I could just reach one more potential listening human brain of an infinite number of human brains based on that iTunes suggestion, I consider that a win. And as always, you can also support the show directly with money! I like money. If you enjoy what you're hearing each episode, you can donate at least $1 a month to the show at patreon.com/ihabitradio. That is patreon.com/ihabitradio. Go to patreon.com/ihabitradio and become my patron. You'll be joining a very attractive and intelligent group that already support me there. That $1 goes a really long way and is deeply appreciated. I like it very much. And alas, my elder flower, Saison, is gone. It's been annihilated. It's very, very dry. A little hard to do the show, but hey, that's what happens. Anyway, it's time for me to go. Please tell your family, friends, neighbors, pets, plants, aliens, and insert something referential and witty here about the show, and that they can find it on Google Play Music, on iTunes, on Podomatic, on Stitcher, and on Spreaker. And please send me feedback, story suggestions, and beer recommendations to Gary@pulpanddeckle.com, or on the Twitters and Instagram at iHaveItRadio, or even on the Facebook at facebook.com/iHaveItRadio. It's time for me to go. I will see you in the future. Bye-bye!